Today's program, I should say, will be somewhat unusual, I suppose, when judged against your sort of baseline Washington, D.C. think tank event. And it will be different in at least two ways. First, it will be the first public live show of our podcast, the Eastern Front, on which Yulia, Giselle and I talk about the challenges to European security that have erupted along the line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea and about why those matter to the United States. By the way, you can find all 173 episodes that we've recorded thus far on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And secondly, after a 45-minute conversation, we'll screen a film, which is also not commonly done at research organizations of this kind. The film is called Before Bucha Was Abkhazia. It's a documentary that I think provides a very compelling body of evidence suggesting that there is a common thread going through Russian actions in the 1990s, in Georgia, in the Northeast, in Georgia, and what we are seeing now in Ukraine. And we do believe that direct, unintermediated testimony of war crimes by people who were there and saw these events unfold firsthand might be more enlightening than your usual think tank style conversation. So the film has around about 45 minutes of mostly archival footage, which documents this Russian playbook. And it was put together by a group of young activists associated with European Georgia, Movement for Liberty, which is a political party in Georgia. Some of them are in the room, and I think they'll be happy to chat with you informally after the event. And I want to thank all of them for coming and for bringing this message to Washington. Now, as always on our podcast, I'll be joined by my friends Giselle Donnelly and Yulia Zhozha. Giselle is a senior fellow at AEI. She's a military historian working on European security, but also on a large-scale book project on the emergence of American strategic culture. Yulia is the director of the Black Sea Security Program at the Middle East Institute, and she teaches at Georgetown and George Washington University. And she's also working on a manuscript on the Black Sea and Black Sea security. We are very lucky to welcome Giga Bokeria to our podcast and to AEI today. Giga is the leader of European Georgia, a political movement, political party in Georgia. He served as deputy foreign minister of Georgia. He served as the national security advisor to President Saakashvili. He was a member of parliament. He was also a student activist back in the day, founder of the Liberty Institute, one of the key figures in the Rose Revolution of 2003 that set Georgia on the path towards liberal democracy, pro-market reforms, and a European future for Georgia. Giga, welcome. It's a tremendous pleasure to have you at AEI. Now, I envisage that we'll end up talking sooner or later about current events in Georgia. There is, a lot that's happening that has kept Georgia in the news, but it might be useful to actually go back in time a little and to perhaps focus on the topic of the film itself, because I suppose that most people in our audience will have some recollection of the 2008 war that Russia waged against Georgia, but some of you might have a hazier memory of the 1990s and of the disintegration of the Soviet Union and the self-styled peacekeeping role that Russian forces took on themselves in the region. And indeed, some of us might even struggle placing Abkhazia, the once Soviet Riviera, on the map. So I wonder if you could perhaps sort of set the stage for the film initially and tell us a little bit about what exactly happened in the 1990s in Abkhazia, how it was subsequently memory-holed, more or less, and how this film helps bring this memory back to life and why it matters for the present day.
Thank you so much. First of all, I want to thank AEI and Giselle Alibor and Yulia for this opportunity. It's very important for us to have a chance to not only recall the events of 30 years old, but to connect those events to the current threats in our region, to my country, but I would argue much further than our country. I want to use the opportunity from this stage to thank everybody who helped us to gather the material, the evidence, and then to shape the product that you will see, or part of the products that we created. Some of them, as you said, are here and using the chance, and there are people back home who've been throughout all these years gathering this material, people from the civil group Abkhaz Union. I want to use the chance to thank them, and Liberty Institute and Tabula. Now, about your question, why we consider it important and what's the connection and what what was happening then. Obviously, there is, from my point of view, moral imperative too, to try to bring justice to people who suffered these unspeakable atrocities that you partly see there, and to give them voice, because at the time, because of the legitimate rejoicing of everybody because of the break of the empire of evil, Soviet Union, the events afterwards got lost in this smoke of great happiness, which we do share. That was the greatest day in our recent history when that empire fell apart. And we Georgians and political leaderships that we had failed to position ourselves as part of the Europe at the time. So all of these events went unnoticed or were labeled as some trouble which follows the breakup of the empire, some ethnic conflicts of troubling country, which where there is no bad and good guys, it's just trouble. And there is no strategic importance for Euro-Atlantic security. And what this film will show that much earlier than there was any talk of EU or NATO enlargement in Caucasus, the Russian leadership before Putin, led by so-called Democrat Yeltsin, planned, implemented, orchestrated, and then directly participated in military aggression against Georgia, creating proxy structures, having the same narrative they tried to have in Ukraine, that it's an ethnic conflict between communities. But unlike Ukraine, at that time, they were successful in labeling it as that. Then implementing a brutal campaign of genocide against Georgians. And this wall was motivated by their fundamental strategy not to allow successful statehood at its borders. And this is a critical thing to say, why I underlined that NATO and EU enlargement was not at stake at all, because we still hear, even after this latest phase of Ukraine invasion, this completely false notion that somehow maybe Western actions or actions by Georgian governments, different governments, or Ukrainian governments have caused some insecurity of Russian political class or current political leadership. And maybe this can be avoided if there are assurances given to them about NATO, no further NATO enlargement, and so on. So this is fundamentally flawed, and that history that you see demonstrates that Russia's strategic vision, not only of Putin, but of a majority, overwhelming majority of political and unfortunately public class, sees an outcome of the Cold War, their defeat of the Soviet Union, as big tragedy. And they want to reverse the results of the end of the Cold War. And in order to reverse that, they need to challenge the Euro-Atlantic security architecture, they need to challenge United States' role in that sphere, and for that they need not to allow any successful statehood in Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, or elsewhere. And that's where we are. And one more detail, it's a long introduction, but we now hear a lot of talk about peace, and that's a nice slogan, that everybody wants peace, and people are dying, children are dying, and it's sometimes very, in a good way or bad way, seducing to say that, well, we must do everything to have peace. And I won't even argue into discussion what is a fair peace or not fair. Obviously, you understand all that. For me, a fair peace in Ukraine or Georgia is when Russian occupying troops are out of our sovereign territories. But even without that, what this movie shows, or and recent history of any negotiations with Russian regime shows, that until there is a clear political military defeat that they face, any peace negotiations, any peace deal will be used for further aggression. So for those who want peace, let's say peace is not achievable. There'll be more bloodshed, more victims, more children will die if unfair and unjust peace or peace without clear defeat of Russia is achieved for time being. And that's what happened in Abkhazia 30 years ago. That's what happened in Georgia in 2008. That's what happened in Ukraine after the first Crimean invasion, the Minsk Accords. That led us to the current situation. And any further attempts to pacify situation by some temporary deals will bring more bloodshed, more resources. And last but not least, I need to come back to the fundamental issue because I think it resonates with the debate which is here in the US now. Again, any postponement of reaction to Russian aggression in Ukraine until it reaches further Western countries. And the notion that Russian don't target US is also fundamentally flawed. For them, US is a heart of evil, and they need to attack US interests or Western interests anywhere they can reach. They can be allies with Islamist fundamentalists or left-wing guerrillas. Doesn't matter ideologically. The same way as it's an outrageous mistake to consider Putin or Russian political class as defenders of any values whatsoever. And they claim now that they're defending so-called conservative values from their point of view, from woke extremists, liberal, globalist West. But they had some success in penetrating that idea, and we need to fundamentally reject that. They would quote woke left when they want to label US as racist. They will quote Tucker Carlson when they want to say that woke extremists are a face of modern Western civilization. They'll do both at the same time. They can afford to be contradictory. And we need to completely dismiss this notion and label them as what they are. Enemies of liberty everywhere, enemies of US as a leader of the free world, enemies of any free nation who wants to have a sovereign state like Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, or anywhere else.
I wonder if you could perhaps, for the benefit of the audience here, just sort of like zoom in into the 1990s and just describe sequentially what would happen.
If I may, I will not zoom too deep, but just a couple of words, what predated that? That Georgia, many might not know, had a chance to have first democratic republic as early as 1918. And we had first republic, we had elections. Social Democrats won. I'm no fan of social democrats, but they were European social democrats. Unlike Russian Bolsheviks, they didn't exterminate their opponents. There was a very tough political battles in our parliament, but it was European coexistence. And what is remarkable about Abkhazia and about many other parts of Georgia where they were ethnic minorities, there were three elections held, federal and two local elections, including in Abkhazia, where population participated, and there was a political consensus reached to have a joint federal state. And that's very important. Russians, both red and white Russians, tried to interfere, but they were rebuffed until 1921, when under Stalin's initiative, our statehood was crushed in blood. After that, instead of having civic nationalism, the Soviet regime, under Stalin's guidance, have installed the chauvinistic, tribalistic ideology inside our communities and have cultivated hatred for decades. So when we arrived at the end of the 80s, when majority of Georgian public were cheering for getting back independence, they managed to cultivate inside Abkhazia a political cluster under ethnic wrapping who would cheer for preservation of Soviet Union. So that's why if you take archive footage, you will see that Georgian soldiers are pulling down the Lenin statue, which was proudly preserved by local separatist authorities. But what is most important is that all of it was FSB coordinated. You will see in the film that the major organization which led the military action against Georgia was a confederation of North Caucasian peoples. And it was very comfortable to say it's not Russian conflict, it's like Caucasian tribes fighting each other. But you know what happened to that organization? It disappeared after Abkhaz War. And people who were connected with them, we found evidence later on, including those who then were implicated into terrorist acts, like Mr. Basayev, some of you might know, were directly working at the time for Russian special services. So this was a conflict which brewed for years before it broke out, and the core of the conflict was that you had Russian proxies who jeered that Soviet Union must be preserved, and you had a Georgian public, Georgian community, Georgian political forces who were striving for independence, and then Russians managed to transform this debate into an ethnic rivalry and ethnic clashes. And then the story was that it's a fight of small ethnic nation against big invader Georgia to give them independence. And you'll see that this is the flag which Russians try to use even now, but in that case they were successful, not only militarily, but also ideologically and propaganda-wise. Even amongst our partners, the cliche up to date is that it was Georgia-Abkhaz conflict. And that's something we challenge based on all of these materials that we gathered here, that all of these individuals which are participating that were under vertical of military and security command of Russian forces on the ground and starting from top level. And some people that you might hear the name Shoigu, who is now Minister of Defense. And you'll see in the film that he was a key figure then, mediator between Georgia and Abkhaz forces, and of course, playing the game that Georgia was an aggressor and then orchestrating the offense. So you will see that we had Ukrainian volunteers in this film who fought on Georgian side, and some of them, very young, very articulate, are giving us some visionary statements saying that they are here, they were there, because they understood that if Russia is not stopped there, they will have to fight in 15 years in Ukraine. And unfortunately, it turned out correct. They are still fighting, some of them who are alive now in Ukraine, and Shoigu is Minister of Defense and is organizing the genocide of Ukrainians in Bucha and elsewhere. And I think if we need to learn something from those examples of the 90s is that this history should not be repeated further and anywhere else. And we should once and for all build a wall around Russia, Russia as it is now, of strong liberal democratic republics, members of NATO, part of the defense alliance of the West. So for once and for all, adventurism of Russia towards West, this appetite is gone. Any other alternative is misleading.
I wonder if you could tell us a bit about your view of the Abkhaz people themselves. I remember from primarily from Russian propaganda and what would filter through Western advocates. There were two sort of contradictory views that are part of the narrative. One was that they were either sort of hillbillies who were small tribe unto themselves, but conversely, that they were primarily Russified and that their natural inclination would have been to remain, if not part of the Soviet Union, then looking to Moscow for political leadership. Tell us how that's right or wrong.
I think the second description is much closer to reality, not Russified in a sense that they would identify themselves as Russians, but they would identify themselves as part of the Russian world, Ruskin, and would opt for any arrangement where they can be junior partners in a Russian arrangement other than that. But when I say they, it will be wrong to condemn all ethnic Abkhaz to have that view. I think they haven't never had a chance of any free debate together with other citizens of Georgia, unlike 1918, 1921, that's why I recall that moment, when there was a small brief period to reconcile your ethnic identity with your civic political identity of being a citizen of a bigger country, which was successful at the time. After that, any attempt to do that on the side of Abkhaz community would be reacted with repression. I mean, we had several examples of ethno-separatistic view holding leaders domestically who became critical of Russia and then, as in many other cases, died in mysterious circumstances. So anybody who tells me that, well, we should take into account the position of Abkhaz community, I say yes, of any citizen of Georgia, for me, regardless of ethnic origin, we should take. What I reject is this, you know, tribalistic approach, that there's one tribe, another tribe, and, well, okay, whatever Russians did, you need to talk to them to make a deal. First of all, there can be no real talk until Russia controls security on the ground, because the free debate is not possible there. And secondly, unfortunately, Russians, as in many other cases, have installed in domestic community leaders, those who are alive, the openly ethno-apartheid style ideology. So you have first-class citizens, second-class citizens, and a minority of ethnic Georgians who survived the genocide are openly considered as citizens with no rights. Their language cannot be used in schools. Any free speech will be suppressed with brutal force, and they cannot vote in their illegitimate elections, even, I mean, symbolically. So, not to give you many other examples of brutalities which are ongoing as we speak, but so that cannot be defeated by dialogue between communities. That can be only defeated when the force which have installed this poisonous ideology is defeated. And then, of course, it might not be an easy process of engagement of communities who had a history of this kind of bloodshed, but I think it's completely doable with Georgia becoming a functional, a liberal, democratic republic where all citizens with their local self-government or regional self-government can feel that their rights will be protected.
So I'm pointing out the obvious here, but I have to do it anyway. I think you mentioned
that's
maybe
scholarship.
Yes. I think you mentioned maybe once, if at all, Putin, right? And I think it's important to underline, because here in the West, both in the United States and in Western Europe, we still are very much entrenched in this understanding that it's a Putin problem, not a Russia problem. And if Putin would only go away, this would solve the problem. The second point, and then I'll get to my question very briefly, is that this resonates very deeply in the entire space that we're talking about. In 1989, Gorbachev, that we associate with the more benevolent Russian or Soviet leader, was visiting his counterpart in Beijing to set the stage for what we see now as a strategic partnership between Russia now and China. And at that same time in Georgia, there was to be re-independent Georgia, where protests of hundreds of thousands, in Ukraine, tens of thousands, all around this region, Baltic, of course, too, and he crushed them one by one, including with victims. And then we're going into 1991, 1992, what you're describing on the eastern side of the Black Sea. On the western side of the Black Sea, in Moldova, it's the same thing. It's almost a copy-paste in the same format of war and then creating a negotiation format in which the aggressor is part of the mediators. And it's something that we are inheriting in the region generationally, and we still haven't found a solution to it. So you've already pointed to that. I want to move us a little bit further into the future and ask you about how the pain and the memory of the early 1990s, as well as 2008, and maybe you can differentiate a bit to the extent that it's possible, is having an effect and an impact now in Georgia. We know that the government in Georgia has been actively trying to amplify this fear that people have legitimately. In Moldova, they have a similar fear that these things could happen again and genocide could happen again. But the Georgian government has been actively trying to amplify and instill this fear further with the argument the Americans are trying to drag us into the war, the Ukrainians are trying to drag us into the war, and we should be staying away from it. And so with that in mind, would you talk us through how this is being handled today from the side of the government, but particularly what kind of an effect this has on the Georgian population?
I will, but let me first say, because you started with saying that I mentioned Putin only once, that is not because I don't see him as a pinnacle of evil, but you're absolutely right. It's my deep belief that it's not a personal Putin problem, what we see in Russian Putin. Nevertheless, I would say removing Putin would be a good news in any case. So I'm all for it if it will be done one way or the other. But our experience shows that we have a deeper problem in the whole Russian political society and political class in general. And this will be only resolved. I've been recalling in a couple of meetings here in Washington also the history. When was the time when Russia has reformed or partially reformed only after military defeats, whether it was Crimea in 19th century or against Japan in the beginning of 20th century on after Afghanistan. And that kind of defeats prompted some liberalization. Again, not enough, not full. But so if we want to have a different Russia where Putin's removal will have an impact and it will be a normal nation state, first and foremost, we must do this minimal thing that they are militarily and politically unsuccessful and are defeated in Ukraine, in Georgia, and in Moldova. Then we'll see whether Putin's removal brings some change, but not to speculate about what can be done without that. Now, our own government, and that's the biggest problem that we have beyond our enemy in the north, is our own government. As we speak, there are tens of thousands, if not more, people on the streets of Tbilisi. And the issue is, for those who don't follow the detail, is that our own government now introduced the so-called Russian law, the law which stigmatizes anybody who is fundraising in the West for its cause, whether it's civil society or media, as foreign agent, and then gives additional powers to the government to investigate, to demand personal details of any interaction they have and to monitor. And by the way, this law is directly connected with the topic of the fear of war that you mentioned. There is a direct connection with that. Why? Because the line of current Georgian political leadership coincides with Russian propaganda, is that West is not willing to engage Russia and will not have resources to do that or political will to do that. So to avoid bloodshed, to avoid children dying under the bombs, we should adjust, meaning we should accept Russian dominance on security front. And that's the only path to peace. And all these NGOs and media groups which criticize this line or criticize government for civil liberty issues or democracy issues are agents of those forces in the West who wants to use us as proxy. And of course, the second line, which I also mentioned, the issue of identity is also strongly there. So, to paraphrase one Putinist politician in Georgia said, they don't want to defend us, but they want to make our children gay. So, that's in one sentence, that's what the line they're pushing. And I would say the first part is much more powerful. I mean, of course, both are poisonous lies, but first is powerful. Why? Because it has an element of truth that there was a time when, despite 90s, despite 2008 and Crimea, there was no readiness in the West to see Russia as a security threat for Euro-Atlantic architecture. And hence, there is rational ground to argue that we need to survive in that reality. Of course, the fundamental line that premises that there is not a single example in our neighborhood of a nation who made peace with Russia without position of strength and is successful as a state. None of examples. Only those who were persistent in their transformation, like Baltic states and Poland, are now peaceful, prosperous nations. Still under threat, but still. Those of us, Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, whose leaderships at different moments have tried this balanced politics or didn't reform their countries or tried deals with Russia, have paid a heavy price. Now I would say Ukrainians, and we paid a price for corrupt and dysfunctional Shevardnadze regime at the end of 90s, when Russia was weak and we didn't use that moment. And I would argue, if I dare, that Kuchma's policies were and then Yanukovych, of course, are the reason why Ukrainians have to heroically fight and have such a sacrifice now. And I would argue not using current moment to solidify our sovereignty will force us to pay much bigger price in the future. Any deal with Russia as it is now will cause much more bloodshed in the future for all of us, as I said. So my own government is playing this card. They've been partially successful until very recently in misleading part of the public that they are not anti-European, they are not anti-Western, they are just cautious. And by the way, until the latest couple of years, their statements were not much different from some European countries' MFA statements. So they said, we are European. We're just saying, oh, look, they want us to make a deal with Russians. They are telling us to do that. So they've been using that. And, you know, fear of war is a normal fear for any normal person, a patriot person. So if the government who is supposed to protect you and is elected to protect you is telling you that, that is not a weak message. But I think now our own government and the oligarch who controls the government has bitten more than they can chew. And we see the reaction on the streets. And hopefully this reaction will transform into a political support for political change. And we know that the elections are coming very soon. Of course, there's a risk that government's reaction with announcements of counter-rallies could lead to violence. And that's a dangerous scenario. And that shows how irresponsible the oligarch's government is. But we will do our best, and it's my hope and my belief that there will be such an overwhelming position of society, such a huge majority and such a big moral majority that it will thwart all of those attempts by our own government to turn us into a situation which Belarus has now. Because that's the past where they are. It's not Belarus yet, but we know that we cannot be complacent, that even with brave people of Belarus, if you allow the regime to consolidate to that degree, then even with heroic protests, you might not get liberty easily back. And that's why people are on the streets in Tbilisi, in Georgia. And I hope it will finish with us having a government which will have our national interest at heart and not just preserving the power at the expense of our future.
Before we open it up, can we just ask you to talk a bit about 2008? We've kind of...
I did. Okay. The biggest difference between 2008 and 90 was that Georgian state was in better shape. Not enough to secure our territory fully, but incomparable to 90s when we had chaos and this complete dysfunctionality. And still, despite insufficient reaction from the West, compared to 1992 and 3, we had support of our partners. Five presidents arrived in Tbilisi. I used the opportunity now to thank all of them. It was late President of Poland Kaczynski, President of Ukraine, Yushchenko, President of Estonia, Lwes, President of Lithuania and Latvia, it's foreign ministers of Sweden, Carl Bildt, and current Prime Minister of Finland, who was a foreign minister. They came, and there was a statement by Bush administration that they're sending military humanitarian aid via planes, and very strong statement, the second statement, which I think was decisive, demonstrating to Putin that it's a risky situation for him if he proceeds further. Of course, what happened afterwards with reset was a serious mistake, to say the least. But again, compared to 1993, 2008, we had this reaction. Georgian state, which was in better shape, and an international reaction, which was late and insufficient, but incomparable to complete darkness in 1993. So again, I want to use the moment to thank everybody who contributed to chance to survive as a state in 2008, despite Russia's declared goal of a regime change, and which would mean in that context a removal of statehood. Not because any particular government is sacred, but if Russia is allowed by military action to install the government they want, that is the end of statehood. So it was Secretary Rice who responded to that request with firm position, and I want to use the opportunity to thank that. Having said all of this, I think there was a deep mistake prior to that by some good people everywhere, including in this town, of underestimating the threat of Russia. And by the way, I use the chance that I sometimes hear that even now, saying that there is another country east of Russia, a big one, with huge resources, which is a real threat. And Russia, because it showed its dysfunctionality, is not. And I think it's also more than a crime, a mistake, to paraphrase one historic figure, because they are together. And it only makes sense to respond to the aggression now rather than allow this alliance of totalitarian states to attack free world from different directions. That would be a danger. Neutralizing a weak link of that alliance is just rational. So saying that there is other big danger, so let's ignore this one, will bring that other danger, will turn that danger much, much bigger threat.
Indeed. So now is a moment, I think, to bring in our audience into the conversation. Let's start here.
Good evening. I'm Giga and Dalibor. Nice to see you again. Giselle, Ilya, pleasure to meet you first time. I'm Chris Orr. Previously, I was senior defense editor for 1945. Now I'm dual-hatted as a military writer for SimpleFlying.com, and I published my own Patreon page called The Dearsenal of Democracy. See what I did there? Anyways, I have a two-part question. I'm not sure if this is a perfect analogy, but just my initial reading about this event, I see some parallels with some atrocities that Russia committed against Poland, namely, one, the Katyn Forest massacre under Stalin during the Second World War, and Borisy 2010 under Putin's regime, the Smolensk air disaster. So I'm wondering if the Russian government is committing the same degree of denial and obfuscation on the Abkhazia atrocities as they were in those two Polish incidents. The second part of my question, think back to the event we had last year when the Belarusian opposition leaders. So what efforts are being made besides this project by the opposition leaders to make sure that this event is not forgotten? Thank you.
Shall we collect your question as well?
I'm Peter Humphrey, an intelligence analyst and a former diplomat. I've met with parliamentarians from your country, and some believe it may be possible to join NATO, even under recent circumstances. And given the Article 5 commitment, I don't see that happening. You've got Russian troops in Transnistria, Russian troops in Donbass, Russian troops in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. And of course, the fear is that Article 5 results in automatic assistance in expulsing the Russians from these four territories. So I think that's unrealistic. But can you tell me how that discussion is proceeding in Georgia, and if there is any chance at all of Georgia joining NATO in relatively recent times?
First, on parallels between actions of Stalinist communist Russia and Putin's Russia or Yeltsin's Russia, with different degrees, but yes, it's the same pattern. It's the pattern of viewing aggression as the main tool and having a vision that, as one of their famous statesmen said, there is no Russia, there is only Russian Empire, that they cannot exist with that. It has never been a case that Russian political class so far made a choice to build a nation state, a normal nation state. It's always empire, which means to enlarge, and brutality is also a feature which they encompassed. And now, by the way, again, it brings me back to the issue I mentioned, that some portray Putin as preserver of conservative values. I mean, this is a political class which glorifies Soviet past, glorifies communism. By the way, a very, very good movie, Death of Stalin, if somebody has not seen it. Or advised
to see. Forbidden in Russia, right?
Yeah, forbidden by this regime in Russia. So that tells you all about, I mean, the brutality and dehumanizing society and individual and depriving public of will and responsibility for its liberty is a signature of communists, Russian communists, regardless of their ethnic origin. End of current Putin's regime. And again, it's not identical, their resources are not identical, but the attitude is identical. So yeah, I see parallels in all of that. What can be done more to bring those heinous crimes to daylight and to then do our best not to allow anything like that to happen in the future or to punish those who can be punished? I think first and foremost, Russia must be defeated now in Ukraine. That's where it starts. And then, and that brings me back to your question, then build this wall to compare, again, not identical historic situation, but President Truman's decision to take Greece and Turkey into NATO in a very volatile period has saved, I would say, free world at the time from much more victims and much more bloodshed. And it was a risky decision. There was turmoil inside. The communists, Russian communists, were meddling into affairs of both countries. They were at the verge of being lost. And that decision and then the doctrine which was formulated brought us here that we are now discussing these issues. Now, about Article 5 and occupied territories in Georgia and Transnistria. Those are occupied territories, sir. It's not just Russian troops being there as tourists, right? There are ways to address that Article 5 might not cover the territories which are currently occupied in Georgia. I mean, that can happen without compromising territorial integrity principle. And there are examples like that. By the way, Article 5 initially was not covering part of Turkey. US-Japan treaty on security doesn't cover the eastern islands, which are occupied by Soviets, but they are considered to be Japan's sovereign territory by all the partners. There are many examples. It's not ideal solutions, I'm not saying, but to suggest that Georgia's or Ukraine's path to NATO is a path to war is a deeply flawed suggestion. War is there. It's not that this will cause the war. War is there, and Russians will continue that as far as they can go. And as I said, based on these examples of 90s, 2008 or Crimea, if the reaction would have happened before. By the way, if the decision in Bucharest in 2008 would have been to bless Georgia's and Ukraine's path unequivocally towards NATO, I'm pretty sure Putin would not take a risk of invading Georgia, because Putin reacts to weakness and is not a fanatical suicide bomber. I mean, he is a murderer, tyrant, but he knows where he has to stop. And the trouble so far has been that the signals he was getting were indicating that it was worth taking a risk and it will give him some dividends. By the way, in Ukraine, one of the factors why he took those risks was reports of his own security people and pro-Russian politicians that Ukrainians will accept Russian Talt proxy regime. And they were deeply wrong. But that shows the anatomy of Putin's decision makers. And all the obstacles on the path of Ukraine's and Georgia's membership of NATO contribute to risks of bigger war, with involvement of NATO member countries in the future. Something which was unthinkable 20 years ago can happen if Putin and its allies to the east and other totalitarian aggressive states are allowed and would see the weakness and would see that the free world is not ready to confront them and not ready to incorporate sovereign nations into their security alliances. So NATO enlargement is a way to peace, but peace with preserving liberty.
I can just add a footnote. We should remember that Article 5 was agreed to when the eastern part of Germany was occupied by Soviet troops. So, it seemed like a risk worth taking.
Absolutely. I think Germany is an absolutely legitimate example. By the way, I had an interaction with some German people, German political class and expert people after the Soviet war. And because Germany had a position, and unfortunately, as I understand, has a position now too, for skeptics enlargement, we talked about solutions to those conflicts, as they call it, which I fundamentally reject. It's not conflicts. It's Russian occupation in both cases. And they told me that engagement, and they gave me an example of Germany's Ostpolitik and Willy Brandt and how it brought. But then I had a simple question to ask them, how successful this policy would be without US and allied troops in Berlin? And he was an honest German expert, told me zero chance. So, I mean, the point is, when we are dealing with regimes like Putin, if there is no indication of political will to protect the free world and to incorporate those who want to be in this world. And by the way, when we're talking about Ukraine, I think Ukraine has showed that its army and its people will be a huge contribution to European security within NATO. Huge. I mean, I think we see that every day. But with the psychology that it's dangerous to make any move because the enemy will accelerate further, that's a psychology of defeat, and that will bring more bloodshed rather than peace.
Giga, I feel sure. That we could sort of go on and on with this conversation, but lest I be accused of really poor time management skills.
My fault. The parliament members are once taught to speak until somebody stops them, so endlessly. So.
No filibustering allowed here, but this has been brilliant. Giga, thank you so much for this conversation, and with the usual sign-off from me, Dalibor Rohat.
Me, Giselle Battley, and
thank you for joining us here on AEI's Eastern Front. You can find more episodes and additional content on our website, AEI.org, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Twitter or X at Eastern Front Pod. We also monitor the same hashtag, and don't forget to sign up for our newsletter to receive more content from the Eastern Front. Again, if you enjoy this event, please consider subscribing, reviewing, and rating us. Thank you, and goodbye.